You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CivCast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new episode of CivCast. This is CivCast 41. My name is Kyle. I'm joined here by my co-host, Dan. Hello, Dan.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And I'm also joined by the other gentleman in the room, Wouter. Hello, Wouter.
Hello, guys. And it's not morning in normal time zones.
It's, yeah.
Normal time zones.
Dan, you're late by 5 minutes, 6 minutes in my time zone. Eh? Anyway, we're here to talk to you about all things Civilization VI and maybe some throwback to Civ V. Hope you guys have enjoyed our last two episodes where we kind of did a little bit of a dive on the way things worked in Civilization V versus VI. We've got some good feedback on the Reddit about that, so thank you guys for sharing. And I'm going to toss this over quickly to Wouter so he can tell you all about the CivCast Challenge and give you a recap for the month of July. Wouter, what are we doing?
Yes, because this challenge is once again something that I wanted to do, something like I don't do usually and something I haven't tried. I still haven't tried yet. I still want to do so, and I'm probably going to live stream it as well later on in the month. But we are starting in the Renaissance era of this game. So that's the big difference. And with that difference, because Renaissance era is like partially halfway through the game, we're also going to play on epic speed, so that you still have the 500 turns. And I've seen a lot of people actually already playing the game and finding out what probably is the fastest victory type. So kudos to those people. You're playing on the continents map. You can choose any leader that you want to start with, any five opponents as well, because the map size is the standard for Civilization VI, which is the small map. Resources are standard, and the difficulty is, as always, Emperor. I mean, yep. We had so much people already filling it in. It's great. I love it.
I know this has been great. We've had so much feedback here in the last 2 months with CivCast Challenge. I mean, it's awesome to see guys participating in it. Welcome Resender in the chat. Resender is an awesome guy. Oh, Wouter, while you're here and you've been talking about this, Resender picked up a cool copy of the latest the Civ.
I saw.
We need to put a thing up.
I was so jelly.
Resender, I think you put that on the Reddit. I know we're not actually using human words.
No, he put it on the Discord. He picked up a Civ 2 box edition, yeah. Actually, with all the booklets and everything like that. It's so cool.
I thought he said he put something up on our Reddit, too. You guys have to look on there. Resender, correct me if I'm wrong. I thought he said he also did a little, or maybe he meant his CivCast challenge. Anyway, yeah, super cool bundle of Civ 2 collector's edition. That is awesome looking.
For £2. £2.
I'm
looking at it right now. That's so cool. It has a little paper tech tree or whatever alongside it.
Oh, I remember having that from Civ 4, man. I still have my physical copy. It had like an instruction booklet that was this thick as well, and that tech tree layout. It was beautiful.
Okay,
I love that.
I was wrong. Resender says he posted a CivCast challenge in the subreddit. I'm flipping the wrong thing there. Resender, yeah, you should post that picture on the subreddit. I think people would get a kick out of that. It is really awesome looking. That is a very, very cool throwback. So thank you for sharing that, man. We really, really appreciate that kind of interaction there. So, recap CivCast Challenge. We've got awesome people diving into that. Can't wait to see more of these stories come out. If you're someone that's looking to play for the first time, head over to our subreddit. That is civcast.reddit.com. You'll see the sticky note at the very top of the page that has the rules and ways to join. And we've already 18 comments into it. So that's a pretty deep for it being what the... Second, wow, we're only one full week into July and we've had that many people play. So thank you guys. That is awesome. Remember, you can keep playing if you want to try and get a different score or something like that. You guys are welcome to dive in or whatever. We also have gotten some cool ideas of what to do for new upcoming challenges. So we always love those. I forget now. Someone gave a great one and I forget what it was. Oh, well, I probably shouldn't try and figure this out on air. Oh, someone said a one city challenge. That might be an interesting one for an upcoming date. That would be pretty interesting to kind of test people's might on just a one city. So we could look into that for a future episode. But kind of going into this week's main discussion, we thought this one would be a little educational for people out there, and we want you to share your feedback on it. We're going to talk about trade routes, and we're going to kind of go a little bit deeper with this beyond the basics, because trade routes in Civilization VI are pretty plug and play. I mean, they were basically the same iteration that we had in Civ V. I mean, nowadays they do the actual road creation for you, which takes away some of the micromanagement from people, which is nice. Some people aren't. So there's some dissenters with that thing, but overall, good system, takes some of the burden off of you. But what? How do you decide to put a trade route somewhere? Is it related to you wanting to build a road? Is it because you want gold first? Is it because you want culture? So maybe I will, let's open this up, guys. I'm going to ask both of you here. We're going to do an opinion question. I myself, I'm going to ask, how do you decide where you send a trade route in the most basic form? Before we dig into this in detail, in the most basic form, your gut decision, how do you decide to send a trade route somewhere? I traditionally go with production. If I can see high production coming from a city, that's where I will send a trade route first before my bigger plan comes into play. So, Valter, do you maybe want to say something quick? How do you decide to send a trade route? Gut instinct.
It depends on what I do. If I want to build a wonder in a city that doesn't produce much production by itself, then I will push all traders I have centered in that city and just go production nuts. But usually, I think using trade routes to actually grow your cities with extra food is probably a lot better.
That's a good one.
Just settle the new city. Let's run 3 trade routes from it. It will grow so much faster, which makes it snowball out of control a bit faster than normally would, because more population means more production, means more everything. You can work more tiles, and it just, the benefit is really huge in those small cities, because the small numbers are adding up a lot faster then. Yep. So that's what I like to do with my basic trade routes in general.
And Dan, how about yourself, sir?
You know what? Valter actually, I remember way back when, before Valter was even on the show and I was watching his deity challenge, one thing that he, I can see him smiling, so he remembers it too. One thing that he really, really prioritized was domestic trade routes, and specifically production-based ones, which I have to be honest, I don't know if I was a bit of a pleb or a simpleton, but I often would focus my trade routes diplomatically. Obviously, if a civ or a city state or something, you know, wants you to send a trade route, and you'll get some sort of boost or bonus for that, as in Civ 5, which I felt was more influential in Civ 5, how critical the trade routes to city states were. I tended to focus internationally with my trade routes. Plus, you know, I would see the benefits from the gold or the science or the faith, and that was, you know, a shiny toy. And domestically, I never really focused it as much as I should. But since I've been doing that, exactly along the lines of what Voucher's saying, I will absolutely heavily prioritize that if I'm looking to get a city up to speed quick. Like, say you have a city in the mid game that you build, and you want to get it up to snuff or up to speed to your other ones as quickly as you can. I will go all out with domestic trade routes. So, yeah, you know, my priorities for it have changed over time. I didn't even really used to prioritize it at all, but I feel like in Civ 6, you absolutely need to, and domestically, it's the most beneficial.
I think you got a great point there, Valter, because when I said production, I guess that ties into it, because you're right. You know, I don't know, in full honesty, I don't know, with the amount of time that elapses between trade routes and when I'm starting a new city, I don't know if I send all of my trade routes for one, just because I rarely have, like, 3 routes that are ready to flop at one time. Maybe that's poor planning. But you are right. What I'll do when I settle a new city is get that trade route moving from that one, usually to my capital or to the next city closest to it, whatever it can reach. But that brings in many bonuses. You know, like you guys were just saying, your international bonuses are food, or I'm sorry, your national internal with your country bonuses are food and production. So both of those helping your city actually grow and then produce those buildings or units or walls, in Valter's case, that produce those walls faster.
They are important, man.
They're very important.
Don't need armor when you've got good walls.
They're very important. You're just our wall spokesperson, so I have to, throw it to you. But also, I mean, what we topped this or started this thing off with was it builds roads. And if you're building a city out there, even if it's just a little bit further away from your capital, or if it's like far, far out there, like like outpost city, it helps to have those roads, because if your neighbor gets a little irked that you settled a city right on their border, you might be sending a lot of troops down that road in, you know, the next couple turns. But I find it interesting when we're talking about this, you know, Dan, like you'd said, how we learned and grow. Valter started off by saying he does domestic. And we were kind of saying, you know, oh, international is very, very tantalizing, because they can offer big gold yields and things like that. But is there, do you guys think, though domestic is very powerful, do you guys see it as less shiny and enticing when you're compared to like, ooh, send it to Russia and they'll give you culture and science and stuff? Does that ever tear at you guys?
Yes.
Yeah. For culture and science, that is more enticing, especially for if you have like Egypt close to you, that could be really interesting because you get food from that as well.
Yeah.
But the gold itself is just not that good of a thing that I want anymore, because you can get gold from your internal trade routes as well with the policies and everything like that. And if you have a lot of trade routes, that's probably a good policy. And gold is in general easier to come by than production and food and culture and science. So yeah, I like the internal much more.
Yeah, you know, dovetailing off that a bit, I felt like, and this is going to sound funny, but I felt like in Civ 6, they kind of nerfed gold. I find that it doesn't feel like something that I prioritize as much as certainly in Civ 5. I mean, in Civ 5, I think the one thing, or rather, the big difference between 5 and 6 as it relates to gold is you can no longer, you know, buy the influence of the city-states, which is ostensibly what you would use gold for towards the end of the game. So I feel like its value has gone down. But definitely with faith and science, I see international routes as a great generator of that. But you know what? I mean, I've seen the light. You know, the benefits from the domestic routes that Wouter expounded on when I would watch him in those streams made me kind of double down on it. And I think it's great. It really does help. I mean, I play a traditionally tall style anyway, even though this game doesn't allow for it. And I think that, you know, pumping up your domestic trade routes is the one way to ensure that you can build tall and can build safe and internal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one a strategy that you could also do is instead of focusing on the smaller cities, just keep focusing pretty much the entire game. Everything in your capital. Make your capital this huge metropolitan city of like millions and millions of people by just pushing all those trade routes in there to make him grow so large that it will literally destroy the world by his awesomeness.
Now, in that way, I mean, because we are talking trade routes, we are going to talk about like what we actually want to prioritize in them. I mean, we know domestic is very, very important. We have decided, you know, gold is something that grows on trees. And, you know, when you have 15 trade routes, then you can worry about gold if you so choose. But what about wonders here? Because that's always a common thing. We've got, what, the Colossus that gives us an extra trade route early on. The Great Zimbabwe is a great trade route thing. I'm going to pull that up, actually. Do you guys go out of your way to ever prioritize those wonders that are trade route heavy?
See, there's a problem with especially Colossus. It's in a place in the tech tree that I generally don't get to early on, so usually I can't pick it up. And the Great Zimbabwe is an awesome wonder if you can place it. The placement restrictions on that are quite hefty.
Yes,
so that's not always gettable. But if I can, I would definitely pick it up. And there are a couple of great merchants and stuff like that that also give you extra trade route. Beautiful. Love it. More trade routes is more better. You just want to have those trade routes because they're always very beneficial to you. There's almost never, unless you build a trade route and it immediately get pillaged by an enemy or something like that, beyond that, you always get like a nice benefit out of it.
Which I feel happens disproportionately in six. I mean, I feel like more than ever, my routes get plundered, particularly by barbarians. And that has got to be still the biggest pain in the ass because of the sunk cost fallacy associated with it. It scares me away from doing certain routes, as I'm sure it does everyone else. But you know, if you see the encampment between capital and city B, I will generally steer away. I mean, I guess I'm too chicken to go clear out the encampment before I do it. But, you know.
That's a thing. Another thing that has make internal trade routes a lot better, right? You have less to do with foreign, like, adversaries like barbarians or potential enemy units. So that way, because you internally usually have things under control. You don't have large swaths of barbarians running around. And if you do, then you might have different problems. But that's another why internal trade routes are so good. They are a lot safer, and that's great. You don't have to buy another trade route.
It's so true. Copper Cutters agrees. He says he agrees with Dan about the amount of pillaging, feeling like it's crazy through the roof. And he also says he trends towards internal trade routes as well. I forget what I was going to say next, but I mean, the Great Zimbabwe, I have that pulled up here. It is a great one. Like you said, Wouter, very, very hard to place. I do find myself often, if I can, veering towards these trade route wonders. Like you said, they're not very easy to do. But, you know, I've noticed that the Colossus, I will, as a guy that typically plays like a naval heavy thing, you know, I'm already going that route anyway. So it just, you know, the Colossus is typically semi-easy for me to place unless I'm doing something like the Congo, in which case, forget it. And that term, you know, then I'm more often going with like the Great Zimbabwe, because you do have to do, what is it? It has to be placed next to cattle and your commercial hub.
Commercial hub.
So, yeah. That's often a little bit tricky to do. I will find, though, that if I'm launching a game that I'm thinking ahead enough, I will often try to find a place that has cattle that I can save that area, knowing that I will want to use it for that eventually. But I do find, I think you were saying this early on, Wouter, how you were saying make your capital this super huge commercial or super huge metropolitan area that sends out trade routes everywhere. But sometimes this is that weird quirk that you have to deal with, is if you do have the ability and you are willing to put down the Great Zimbabwe, it can sometimes change up where I want to be sending trade routes from, because I guess it also depends on how you prioritize gold, because its bonus is trade routes from this city get +2 gold for every bonus resource in this city's territory. Which also means you got to make sure you have bonus resources out the butt in the city that you're going to do the Great Zimbabwe.
I mean, bonus resources are coming out of Bazoo pretty much. Cattle is so prevalent and stuff like that. So that's usually not the big problem.
No, the big one is settling it and or putting it down to begin with.
Can we talk for a sec about great merchants? And yes. This is maybe appropriate. The other day, or not the other day, it was one of the most recent games I played because of my prioritizing of trade routes. I was getting a lot of great merchants, and I got Levi Strauss as a great merchant. I see Wouter smiling again. Yeah. Jeans is a luxury resource. That is one of the coolest little Easter eggs in the entire game, I think. I was just like, jeans? Hang on, what? That was really cool to see. I like how they've done great merchants in this game, though. I think that they've tied it in a lot, at least the ones I've seen or prioritized, usually have some sort of envoy bonus as well involved, which is a great way to kind of tie it into diplomacy, and which is something I think that they could build on in later iterations where, as we anticipate, they're going to up the diplomacy system in the game.
And that's a great point, because I find the great people system, I mean, I don't know if this is the time and place to have that huge conversation, but I find it to be very, like an exciting side challenge, because the bonuses that you get from it, like to your point, Dan, one of my like little personal goals in the game, and it's not really a great strategy, but it's one of the things I like to do, is try and snag all the great merchants. Like if I lose like one great merchant, I'm like, dang, why did I let that one go? Some of them I don't care so much about because they're a little bit lame, but like you said, I mean, you get a lot of envoys from it, which means you can make a bunch of suzerain states faster. That extra economic policy slot is major. I mean, you're talking, there's ones that give, let's see, who's this? I'm not even going to try and say his name, but increases trade route capacity by 1. 4 trade routes to the city provide +2 gold for both cities. Like, there's some awesome, great merchants out there that make huge changes to your income, although whatever we want to say about income. I love income.
Still need it.
Yes. And this stuff is a great way to supplement that. I mean, if you just can easily go, and this comes from having, your commercial hub anyway. So you're already working towards it. Sometimes I just throw some extra cities on working for commercial, what are those called? Projects? You know.
Yeah, the commercial.
Just a little side game that I like to play.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love the fact how they did great merchants in there, that they're also like semi-random, randomized in the deck, that you don't always get the same ones every game, pretty much. And that's great.
That is a good point. That's something I often forget about. It seems like you get a lot. So what, do we know what that is? Like, are they all randomized or some of them always there? Is there a rhyme or reason?
No, I think they like stacked in, like each era has a certain amount of great people in there and they pick them out at random out of that era.
Got it. Because it feels like some, yeah, I guess that's true. It just, it feels like some of them I always see, like the one I was just talking about, that extra trade route capacity, that feels like mm-hmm. one I always see. It doesn't mean it's always there.
There
for
are
sure.
a couple that give extra trade route capacities though, so maybe you get like through that. Like Zangqiang, indeed, it does get often, but there are a couple of others that also get an extra trade route.
Because Marco Polo comes then. That the one I was talking about was in the classical, but then Medieval's Marco Polo. So yeah, that's a good point. All okay. Right. Yeah, that'd be back-to-back. I probably wouldn't notice the difference of that one.
There is another one as Melita Benz as well, gives another trade route capacity. I believe there was another one as well.
Adam Smith gives you the economic policy slot, which is the most OP of all them. Appropriately so, because he's the most OP economist of all time.
Bless you, Adam Smith, and your extra trade route policy spot. Oh, he made the Bible of capitalism. Excellent. As Adam Smith once said, trade is the lifeblood of nations. So has been beaten into my head. Thank you, Beyond Earth, for that one.
That would be wealth. That would be wealth of nations.
It's a great book, and if you find it interesting, I can recommend to read that as well. I have it in my closet, at least.
If you find Wealth of Nations interesting, I question your... What you find interesting?
Sure. You can question that, but I enjoy reading that actually.
Fair enough.
Someone's got to enjoy it, right?
I'm weird like these guys. I like economic theory and stuff like that as well. So
cool.
Self-admitted weird. That's okay. We need that, Valter. We need that. Help us. Okay, so yes, literally help us though. So okay, we decided that internal trade routes are basically the best. So. But that being a given, what is the next sort of thing that encourages you to go outside of an internal? Or do you just avoid it totally? I mean, that would feel a little bit sad and maybe like that needs its own tweaking system then. If we do feel that, you know, going like ever, almost ever going outside of your city or your nation is a bad thing. Do you prioritize that at all, Valter? Or do you just really stay domestic with those?
Well, there is one thing that makes me go international really easy, and that's e-commerce. It's a policy that you unlock at the globalization level, and it gives +5 production and +10 gold from international trade routes. That's a big one that I like to go for international, especially if I'm doing a science victory or anything like that. That extra 5 production, that's more than you can get domestically, and you want all the production. So yeah.
Copper Cutters kind of leans into what I just said. He said he totally avoids it. He thinks he's missing something, that he's just not doing anything except domestic trade routes.
I mean, eventually, I sometimes, if I focus very much on it, the policy is called e-commerce. It's in the globalization civic. And sometimes I literally run out of places where I can set my trade routes to. If I just focus on my capital city, for example, and then sometimes I will go international as well, because sometimes I can pick up a couple of production from there as well. So then if I really want to focus on one city becoming really strong and awesome, then it can be useful going international if you just literally run out of cities where you can go to.
Does that mean we need more incentivizations to, like, in future iterations and tweaks of the game? Because it sounds like that e-commerce policy is a great incentivizer for you, that, you know, it actually, that one policy does encourage you to go outside of your borders. And though I fully support, you know, the domestic trade routes, I think that's fine. And I use them a lot myself, especially with the new cities. I do vary it up. Not so much for the min-maxing side, you know, but by vary it up, I mean, I do send them outside of my cities. Not, it's against probably the min-max of it. I mean, you could say it's better to do domestic, but I guess I just like the flavor of it to feel like I'm sending them elsewhere, because that's kind of just how history has been, you know, like that you just send trade routes other places to get different things. I mean, I am not a min-maxer, and I will never claim to be one. You know, I don't play the game. I play the game for kind of like the spice of it, not for the... can I do anything quickly in it? So the question is that I would ask, do you need like more incentivizations to come into the game to encourage people to send them abroad? Because that does seem like that's how Civ probably should be in a way, is that you would want probably a fair amount, like 50-50.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that does incentivize me, and I mean, this probably has to do with the fact that I almost always go for a science victor and lean heavily on science. Science, if you see a Civ, that international Civ to trade with, and they're pumping out like plus 5, 6, whatever science, that will incentivize me. But it just, I just don't, I mean, with culture and faith and stuff, I just don't see the benefits to that when I'm doing the international routes. Certainly, they're certainly not as apparent as when you're going domestic and you're getting the production bonus in a hub or the food bonus that you see when you're up in one of your cities. You're right, though, Kyle. I mean, it would, it's a good idea. International trade routes are probably the way the game should be played. But right now, it's other than science, I just don't really get incentivized, to your point, to do it as often.
See, there is a big problem with it, though, with making the parallel to like the real world, I find. And that is one of the big reasons why you would send a trade route internationally in the real world in every time is to get something you don't have at home or you can get elsewhere cheaper. And trade like that gets done at a diplomatic level here. If you want, if your city, your society doesn't have silver, you buy silver from Spain, for example. And that's not something a trade route does. So
it's a very good point.
That makes like the real life comparison of why you would send a trade route is almost negated by that. And in this game, that that's just really weird in that way. I mean, if you could get like the luxury resource from that city you're trading with, then all of a sudden it becomes a super huge boom to actually send your trade route there, which would fit with the analog, but it wouldn't really work because it's so much tied into the diplomatic system right now.
Which is interesting. And I guess, you know, me, I just I guess I look at the game theory behind it because I do think that there should be, we don't want this to be a full real world application, but at the same time, I mean, I just, then do we cut the system? Do we make it so you can only trade within your country? I mean, I don't want that to be the case, but like, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't like dead ends in games. So like, it sucks that there are areas that people would highly recommend against just because a certain area isn't up to snuff, which then, you know, the efficiency person in me would say, well, then just slice it out of the game, you know, or change up the system completely is what I'm trying to get, I guess, the conversation to is that the thing? Do we decouple actual resources from the diplomacy system, or does it become a different branch of a diplomacy system? Because because you are right, Valter. I mean, you're trading externally to get things that that you don't have in a certain spot. And also, I mean, here's maybe a question. I guess when you're looking at domestic trade routes, one thing that doesn't, I guess, make sense on paper would be when you send a trade route to a city that has food, that city that's sending the food to the lesser city, it doesn't actually lose that from its actual food gain per turn, right? That's not a mechanic that's in there, is it?
No, that's right. You literally so generate
like fake food.
But I mean, it's kind of, you offer your surplus that you have to another city, and that city offers their surplus if they like specialize their crop. And you can, the same goes for production. Like, this city produces really high quality timber, while another city has great quality bricks or something like that. And you exchange that, and that results in like a boost in productivity in both cities. I mean, it kind of could work like that. That you just send whatever you have surplus of and get it additional from other places.
Yeah, it's not, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I do believe that we should probably be incentivizing the external trade routes. I mean, if it's going to be a facet of the game, period, I feel like it should at least be a decent area of the game and not be one that people are like, well, should I be using that more? Oh no, we shouldn't, because it's just not good.
So how about this suggestion?
Yeah.
I have a suggestion then. You have the policies, caravanseries in foreign trade. Mm-hmm. Later on, you have triangular trade with mercantilism, which gets replaced by e-commerce later on. That specifically goes for international trade. Why not make all those policies only for international trade? For triangular trade, I can completely understand that actually being an international trade thing, because that is literally what triangular trade pretty much was. Caravanseries, mostly so as well. They were not that necessary for internal trade routes. So that would make internal trade routes a lot worse, because you would need at least to have some international trade routes, because you would get no gold from your internal trade routes anymore.
Well, that'd
you
be
have
an
to supplement
one.
That gold a little bit somewhere, so you need at least a couple of international ones.
I think that would be a pretty good one. Dan, do you have thoughts on that? You in favor?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think when you look at it from a mechanical standpoint, that's probably the one way you could do it. I do like what Wouter was saying. If I kind of understood what he was saying before, the idea of maybe certain cities or certain civs not having a surplus, but maybe having a better quality of a certain resource or something like that, and making that somehow involved in the diplomacy. I could see that working on some level. But, you know, as it relates to the actual idea and the principle of, like, you know, should they cut off international trade routes, or should they be completely overhauled? I would probably fall somewhere in the middle. I mean, you need them, and you need a certain, if they serve a certain purpose beyond just the mechanic of, okay, here's +4 production versus +2 science. Well, I'm obviously going to go +4 production. And it can be weaved into the diplomacy. And I think that if they manage to do that, then they'll find a good balance. And I think that's something that's probably on the horizon.
I mean, you do it a little bit. I mean, you get a diplomatic boost if you have a trade relationship with somebody through trade routes. So it is kind of a little bit tied into the diplomatic system. And especially if you want to do a tourism victory, then it is 100% required, because you get more tourism from a city, from a civ with whom you have a trade route. So it is a little bit tied into that.
Absolutely. I think, I'm in no favor of cutting out international trade. I quite like it. I think what I've learned from this, before we kind of wrap this conversation up and move on to our next about Spain, a big trade nation, is that I think what catches me with the international is it's just a little shinier. I feel this is just an observation of myself. I feel like, yes, of course, there's huge value to the internal trade routes, and I would never want really to do away with those. But I guess what turns me off of the domestic ones is it's almost like you're just getting the same thing over and over again, and I could make an argument that therefore could be almost automated in a way. I'm not saying that's the route we should go, but, you know, with the current system, it's like, I think that the idea of going abroad or outside of your country is to be like, ooh, look at those shiny things you could get, like culture and science and gold and production and blah, 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 blah. But, I definitely think you're right, Wouter. I think it lacks, because I think you can do better with domestic trade routes. I've even been leaning that way more. I guess my end of the day thought is that I just would hope that they would give it a little bit of a bump so that people are interested in doing the international trade again, seeing as it's been like a staple for them for a while. Because if we were to go to a system that they theoretically, again, not encouraging this, but if we're going to go to a system where they're like, well, international trade sucks in this game, so we're cutting it out, then if we were just stuck with domestic trade, I would say, but I don't even want the trade system then. Just take care of it for me, internal management system. I just, why? Why make me even bother with that and just ignore the trade? But these are just weird game observations and things that get tweaked over time. And I overall really like this trade system. I think it works really, really well. I think they've improved upon it a lot since Civ 5. I like the idea that we now don't have to worry about land units versus ocean units, and now they kind of just function in the same way. They've made huge improvements.
So much better.
Huge quality of life improvements.
Yeah.
I guess, we did have other things to talk about here. So I want to call out people's attention to a post that's on our subreddit, because it was an interesting one, and I want to save it for next week, but it was ironically by Finances1212. He wrote in and said, hey, I was hoping to get viewers and the host of the show to discuss some suggestions I'd like to see in the game, so Civ 6. I thought it was good since we were discussing Civ 5. To put it bluntly, he liked vassalage systems in Civ 4. I want those to return. Wants the World Congress to return. Wants proxy wars to return. That's paying gifts and units to civs and city-states to fight it out with other nations, and also civil wars. We've talked about this a little bit on the show in the past couple weeks on and 10% off. But I want to encourage people to go over to the subreddit and give your thoughts there, because if you guys post, it would be cool to come back next week and chat about that in more detail and share people's posts. We have a lot of thoughts on it. Like I said, we've trickled in some things here and there, but we'll save that to next week. And then Copper Cutters, thank you for being in the chat here. I wanted to call out your post quickly, which is, he said, so I was curious what you guys think of the ongoing situation that he's helping to perpetuate in his games. He is finding he's sticking with Merchant Republic once he gets it, and using the international trade routes to boost his end game production. I am playing on Prince King difficulty. He does his best to get the Forbidden City, Big Ben, and Adam Smith. We kind of talked about almost all of those in this. If this works, I can usually roll 15 plus trade routes international while boosting my economic civic policies through the Wonders and Adam Smith. I typically win via science, religion, or culture. I'm wondering what others players think about this practice. Are the higher forms of government more effective and efficient for achieving victory? I hope this makes sense. So, to boil that down and to clarify, he did mean domestic trade routes within that post. So he's all domestic trade routes. But basically his argument is, hey, the Merchant Republic gives you extra trade routes, so he's sticking with Merchant Republic. And So is it better for him to go on to another policy? What do you guys stand on that? Should he be upgrading to a different government?
Well,
for sure. Well, yeah, go ahead.
Copper Cardas is one of our Patreon backers as well, so thank you for that, Copper Cardas. And I will actually, my next strategy session will be talking about government types and policies and the civic tree. So I will talk about more about it later, why exactly, but I would say you should upgrade. And especially, I think you should upgrade to, if you like the productions so much from the internal trade routes, go for communism. That will give you nearly the same boost to a bit spread out through your cities, but it's probably worth it, if only for the envoys that you get out of it.
Clarification, Copper Cutters did not write that wrong. I read it wrong. I apparently read internal as international, which is very tricky because they are very opposite things. But to your point, Valtteri, yes, I always upgrade to communism because I, A, am a communist, and B, because, come on, it's awesome, and it gives you a lot of bonuses.
I do like the spread, the card spread you get with Merchant Republic, the two wild card slots, one diplomatic, two economic, and one military, very balanced. So that spread is good. I think communism does something similar, though. I just loaded it up here. Three military, three economic, one diplomatic, and one wild card. So I think that seems like a pretty natural way to fold, ironically enough, to fold from a Merchant Republic to a communist state.
Yeah,
right? That's really funny, actually.
Yeah, it is. But, I mean, if you're okay with having fewer card slots, then stick with Merchant Republic. I mean, it does have its benefits. Its legacy bonus is not all that great. I'm looking at it right now. Additional minus 1% discount on gold purchases every certain amount of turns. So its legacy bonus isn't all that great, but its active bonuses are.
So the legacy, the active bonus of Merchant Republic, just so we're all clear here, is plus two trade routes, 15% discount on purchases with gold. And then you flip over to communism and you lose those plus two. You lose those trade routes, is that right? I don't have that pulled up.
You lose the trade routes, but you keep the sum of the legacy bonus based upon how long you've been a Merchant Republic.
Wait.
Yeah.
Every 15 turns on standard? Yeah, every 50 turns you get 1% legacy bonus on standard speed.
I'm trying to pull up. Where is it? There we go. It's high. Yeah, okay, here we go. It's hiding. Yeah. So the land unit gaining defense, meh. I mean, that's great, actually. But, you know, it's not as exciting as two extra trade routes the industrial zone districts can defend. But the plus 10% or bonus to all production, that's
and for every 20 turns you stay on it, it gets another extra percent. And the thing is, you gain more envoys and influence points than you get with the previous one as well. And that's usually the closer why it is so good to upgrade to the next tier as well.
So as torturous as it is to give up those plus two trade routes and to get rid of your reduction on gold purchases, it is better to upgrade, I think, is our consensus here.
I think so.
Yeah. So upgrade to communism. Woo!
I think it's a good thing that it is good to upgrade, because it would be weird. I mean, you could stay in Merchant Republic for the rest of the game, but I think it's good that they have those higher tiers of government in there, and you should be using them as well. Otherwise, they were probably not designed well enough.
Ditch your bonds of merchant republics and go become communist. Flip your state overnight. Huzzah! That is a really funny transition, though, Dan. I'm glad you kind of called that out. But
well, it is. It's natural in the game.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Just like that. So, okay, we need to talk about Spain. How much time do we have left? We have about 20 minutes left here to do all of our wrap-ups. So, Valter, who wanted to take it away with Spain? Was it you, Dan, or Valter? I forget. Raise your hand, whomever wants to.
You know what? I mean, I could bring it up. We were talking about trade routes before, and Spain's one of those civs with treasure fleet that has trade route bonuses built inherently into their structure. I think Spain is a civ I remember seeing on the tier lists that was ranked pretty low on the tier lists that we were looking at. The tier lists don't really expound on why that is. So I guess I would draw the question to you guys, either of you, whoever wants to answer it. Why do you think Spain would be put down so low on these tier lists? Because the two times I've played them significantly in the game, I really enjoyed it, and I found them to be powerful. Now, I will grant you that they're probably a lot more powerful on a sea or ocean-based map than they are on, like, a Pangaea, most definitely, because, I mean, that's what Treasure Fleet does. But, I mean, I think the Conquistador is great. I like the mission a lot as a unique infrastructure, and I find them to be like a top shelf civ in my experiences. So why do you think they're so lowly ranked then in the tier list?
Well, first of all, I have to say, because it's Philip II, that I as a Dutchman need to rank him low on the tier list.
Oh.
But beyond that, they're really limited in what they can do. They are okay at a religious victory. They're really good, I think, in a religious conquest victory because of the conquistador combined with like an enemy religion and stuff like that. You get really powerful units if you put like an apostle or a missionary there. But that's about all they can do. And since sea-based things are not really that much of a thing, and especially since continents really don't give you that much, it makes them, their bonuses are not amazing. When you have something like Poland who can steal towels, or you have like the insane production bonuses that Australia get, or a lot of other cities, they're just generally not that great, except for those very specific cases. And if your civilization is very specific case-based good, then you're generally a worse civilization because you can't play every game to that specific thing. You need to be adaptable to be best civ.
And you know me, I'm not a huge Philip fan because there's the religion aspect to it that you've got to play into, and I just don't play that game. I don't play those sort of games.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. And I guess, you know, with Spain, you do play kind of the same style as you would with England. So if you're Kyle, why not just play England, right?
Yeah, that is actually England is a lot better than that. 100%.
That is totally my reason. It's not that I don't want to go and do Spain, because, I mean, I think that they're very historically interesting and stuff like that. And I love the idea of the treasure fleet. And I think Opera Cutters just said that in the chat. But really, it's just that I don't enjoy that side of the game. So there, you're right. I just default to England because, in fact, with them now, with their bonuses, you can get +2 trade routes per city due to their Royal Navy Dockyard and the commercial hub. So for them, you know, that steals the win to England, unfortunately. Sorry, Spain. You just don't capture me.
So Copacarus asked about the treasure fleet, and I, in my strategy tip, I will talk about Spain a bit more, and I will explain exactly how the treasure fleet works.
Ooh, good. Very excited for that. So sorry, do we have anything else to say with Spain, or is that kind of wrap up our Spain
feelings? No, I mean, you guys make good points, and I can see the adaptability versus doubling down on a certain style thing. I think maybe just stylistically I like them. You know, this is going to sound funny, but it's sort of the little creature comforts that get you. I like how they've been like physically designed. I like the look of their buildings. I like their color scheme and everything like that. I think that part is really cool and was done really well. And that attracts me to a civ sometimes. Don't have a boring color palette. Don't have buildings that look crappy. And Spain has some interesting looking ones. I like the mission a lot too. I mean, because it's faith and science. But yeah, you know what? I'm probably just not looking at it deep enough or mechanically nuanced enough. And I'm just kind of going by feel.
I like their flag as well. It's a nice bull hat. I mean, that's really cool.
Yeah, right? that does look cool. Yeah,
you're right.
I just can't help it. As a Dutchman, I just want to see Philip II like laying in the dirt with all his city taken away from him. I'm sorry.
Wow. Fair enough. I mean, you know, fair enough. I don't know. I get that colonization side of it that I like with Spain and obviously England there, and they just don't win it for me. But I should still try them sometime and actually play it out and try and get into it. But because I do like the idea of the mission and all that sort of stuff they have. I don't know. Poor Spain. Sorry, guys.
So it Valtteri, could be you said your religious game for once, just to try it.
It could be.
Maybe that's who we do the one city challenge with. I feel like that would be exponentially difficult, would be to do a one city challenge with Spain, who is a civ
Is there
really,
a
really based on going wide.
Can you lock a game to one city challenges in Civ 6? Is that a thing? Is they used to have that button in Civ 5, I believe, but I don't know if it's in Civ 6.
There is unfortunately no button for that in Civ 6.
I wonder if a mod exists for that. I'm sure there is.
Probably, but just as a rule, don't build any settlers and don't steal any settlers. And if you do, you have to delete them or something like that would be enough.
Yeah, I guess we don't need the opposing AI to abide by the same rule. I mean, if it's a challenge, it would just be, don't build your own settlers. So
yeah, it's just
could be really difficult, but I will see how difficult it is by trying that out beforehand, before we actually start that challenge, if it actually is doable.
Who, because someone said that they almost did it. That's why this idea came up to begin with. I forget who it was, but yeah, someone said, I think they wrapped up our latest Civcast challenge with just two cities or something. So potentially doable, but you're right. It's going to take some research to figure out what game tweaking mechanics we're going to need for that.
Was that Durgrick who did that? I feel like that might have been Durgrick.
It could be, actually.
I don't know. Yeah. I could technically.
Well, we'll highlight his post in a couple weeks anyway.
Yes. Yeah. Good point. Okay. Anyone else? Valtteri, did you share your tip for actually Spain for that? Or do you have another? You just pointing people?
No. I need to talk more about Spain, like the mechanics and stuff like that. This was more superficial.
Excellent. Then Dan, you have a call out, I believe, at the end of the show here. For the book.
I have a witch, sorry.
You have a call out for the books, the book here, the book club.
Oh, yes. So, go ahead.
I thought, should I do the strategy tip?
Yes, sorry. I thought you were just meaning you had hinted at it. Sorry, I misunderstood.
All right, no.
Tip away.
So for today, I want to continue to talk about Spain because he's next on the list. And Spain is good if you play it in that very specific way that I think it shines at, because if you want to go for a science victory or a cultural victory, you don't get much bonus out of Spain necessarily, in my opinion. The mission is one of the buildings that I do like a little bit if you want to go for a science victory, because it gives +1 science if built next to a campus district. Then again, if that is a hill where you can get more production out of, you probably want to go for the production or something like that. Sorry, Dan. It looks beautiful, but it's not that great. But what is pretty useful is their conquistadors. And it's a Spanish unique Renaissance unit. It replaces the musketmen and gets +10 combat strength when it is when there is a missionary, inquisitor, or apostle in the same hex. Usually, when you play a religious game, you don't go for missionaries that much, but for apostles. And if you combine the apostle with a conquistador, you can forcefully just go and conquer other player cities with that super powerful conquistador, because +10 combat strength is a whole lot in this game, where that is almost on par with the next tier unit. So having a couple of those, you have a really powerful unit already. And if you stack that up with your religion that you're building as well, for a more offensive religion than defensive or just expanding passively through just apostles, you can make him even stronger, because Philip II also has an ability where combat units have a bonus of +4 combat strength against players following the other religions. So you can just keep stacking up combat modifiers that make him really, really strong, and you can just go out and crush anybody. And then to come back to the treasure fleet, where Copper Carlos also asked about, treasure fleet makes that you can get fleets and armadas, which are the like combined units, the 2-star and the 3-star for navy units, compared to like the corps and armies for land units. And they are available earlier than usual. They can become available at the civic mercantilism, which is a lot earlier than, I don't remember when they usually get available, but it's quite a lot earlier. And with that, you can get some really strong naval units as well to help your conquistador assault, because it's around the same time, the conquistadors and the that you can get fleets and armadas, and take any naval city as well, because you have super powerful ships that others can't really compare to, because by combining them you give them an extra strength bonus as well, and people just don't know how to deal with that. So that's the really powerful thing. What you also get from the treasure fleet is that you get gold between, if you send a trade route from your continent to another continent that belongs to another player, you get extra gold. And if it's an internal trade route, you get extra food and production. So it's pretty good if you have multiple, if you have an empire spreading multiple continents, then you can get a lot out of your trade routes, internal and domestic. So that's pretty good. All in all, Spain is usually the one that you see as a religious guy, but I think he is just a domination victory civilization in disguise. You have to prick through that a little bit and just go and conquer the world. Make that empire great.
Huzzah! Excellent, Voucher. Thank you. Sorry, I got a little confused.
Yeah, okay,
I should have known. I thought you were just teasing your amazing strategy session that's coming soon.
That's getting later.
Woo! And then, Dan, now I'm officially tossing it to you to tell us about the book club and what's up with that.
Yeah, so the historical minute this week is going to be about the Civcast book club, which is something that has been in the works for a couple months, really, and something that we finally pieced together this past week here. And basically what it's just going to be is a Reddit-run community for us to, you know, take a historical book, a book that's routed in Civ lore to some extent, although this one you might say is a little bit of a stretch, and read it together and talk about it and share it and discuss it. And to build on that too, Voucher and possibly Kyle and I, at the end of the month, for our $1 Patreon subscribers, we'll be doing a 15-20 minute roughly discussion on the book. So that's an added little nuance to it. But this month's book is a great book on modern Chinese history. Kyle was talking about communism before. And the, well, we'll call it economic disaster that was communism under Mao Zedong in China. And specifically, we're going to read the great Dutch historian who lives in Hong Kong, works at the University of Hong Kong, Frank de Cotter, and his book, The Cultural Revolution, A People's History, 1962 to 1976. A little bit of a background for me. I'm actually going to China next year, and I'm learning the language right now for work as part of my job. So it's really cool right now. And if you talk to people, specifically older people, which I have done, about the Cultural Revolution in China, some of the stories you hear are pretty harrowing. They're pretty pretty scary. And it's something that I think is still very much a part of the collective, I don't know what word I'm looking for, collective trauma, I guess you could say, of the modern experience in China. And I think that a book like this really expounds on that history extremely well. It's part of a trilogy that Frank de Cotter has done. He did The Tragedy of Liberation, which is about the beginning of communism in China, then Mao's Great Famine, which is about the Great Leap Forward, and then this is the third part of it. But of course, it's not like it's like Harry Potter. You can read them individually. You don't have to read them in order. And we're going to start with the one that's, you know, the best, that has the best reviews, the one that's thought the best of, and the one that probably historically has the most relevance to today. And that is about the Cultural Revolution, an event whose ramifications are still being felt by modern Chinese people, in spite of all of the modern progress that you see in that nation. So I hope that you guys are able to find the book. You can find it on Amazon. I think Kyle I know that I posted in the Reddit the link. I don't know if, you know, we'll do something else to send that link out there, but we encourage you to pick it up and to share your thoughts on Reddit so we can build this up into a fun little monthly chat.
And I like how you managed to draw a comparison between the Cultural Revolution of people's history to Harry Potter. So there you go. Didn't expect those both in the same sentence, but that is awesome. Thank you, Dan and Valter, for spearheading the book club. Like they said, it's over on the subreddit. You can find the post called CivCast Book Club. There is the link to the book there. And like he said, so to clarify for everyone, that is everyone is welcome to join in and chat about it on the subreddit. But if you do want to donate on Patreon, you'll have access to the little 10-15 minute little discussion at the end of the month that we'll post on there. So that'll be very, very cool. Very excited to see where that goes. Anything else from either Dan or Valter this week? Are you guys good? Any last minute thoughts?
Give us some news for Axis. Jeez.
Guys.
Yeah. They've been eerie silent. I hope something big is happening behind the screens there.
I do too. Well, we can only hope. Until then, why don't you guys go check out our awesome friends over at Non-Toxic Gaming. They're a really cool group online that helps create awesome communities like ours where everyone's nice and friendly and shares thoughts and just makes the internet a better place. We love them. Go check them out. If you want to join our Discord, which I highly encourage you to do, there's a link to it over on the site. You can go to civcastpodcast.com/Discord. Made that, so you guys can check that out. As always, if you need any links to the show, if you're looking for a link to any of our Twitch or YouTube or whatever pages you want, iTunes, you name it, it is over there. It's kyledempsterstudios.com/civcast, or again, you can just type in civcastpodcast.com and you'll find all the stuff that you need. I feel like I've said our Reddit name a bajillion times today, but why not make it a bajillion and one? Go to civcast.reddit.com. That'll take you right to the subreddit. We have increasing amounts of subscribers every week. I think we actually just went up a subscriber since I've had this page open, like as of an hour and a half ago. So thank you to whomever just subbed. Thank you to everyone that joined us in the chat today. We had a record number of people join us both on all three, Mixer, YouTube, and Twitch. So thank you, everybody. Appreciate all your insight. It's great to have people conversing on these. Really, really love it. So what else am I missing? I already shouted out our Patreon, but if you need a link to that, that's patreon.com/civcast. We love all of your donations. That goes to keep our awesome website alive and running. It goes to keep our hosting services there and our mastering software, all that cool stuff. So it keeps these cool episodes coming to you on a weekly basis. Check out Dan, you had your historical extra go up there for June pretty recently. Isn't that right? Do you want to remind people what you talked about for that?
Talked about Russia, talked specifically about the era of Catherine the Great. It's part of a 3 or 4 or whatever part series that I'm going to do of historical extras on Russian history from its inception through to now. I'll find a way to talk about to Mr. Putin, I think, at some point.
Oh, Mr. Putin. Okay. So let's see. Oh, and the last thing to shout out here. Well, Valter's going to have his strategy session coming to Patreon soon. And now, crap, I'm doing too many things are popping into my mind at once. I wanted to say that also on the website, there's that submission form link. We did have someone submit something, some feedback for us, a thing to discuss in the future. I wanted to save that. So to whomever you are that I can't think of your name right now because I don't have it pulled up, thank you very much. Don't worry. It's in my inbox waiting for my attention. If you want to check out later today, we're probably streaming more Diablo 3 on this channel later. We're mending the bonds between the United States and Russia, one game of Diablo at a time. So you can join in for that. Until next week, everyone, that's going to wrap it up. So just one more turn. You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. For more shows like this, visit kyledempsterstudios.com.